Piotr Sauer, welcome back to Today in Focus. Great to see you.
Great to be here.
So you're actually talking to us today from Armenia, and we'll talk a little bit about why you're there later on. But you're our Russia Affairs correspondent. You grew up in Moscow and you lived in Russia until Putin decided to launch his full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And I know that you're still in very close contact with a lot of people in Russia. How are they feeling about their lives these days?
So for the last few weeks, I've been gathering as much information as possible for several stories I wrote for The Guardian about the mood in Moscow and in Russia. And the picture I got was a country that is growing more and more tired of the war, that has now entered its fifth year, both of the general population and as well as the elites.
Mm. I don't know how reliable polling is in Russia, but has much research been done to try and take the temperature of the population?
Yeah, of course, polling in an deeply authoritarian country should be taken with a grain of salt. But we've seen from a number of indicators that from the beginning of this year, really, Putin's ratings have fallen. His approval has fallen. One poll showed that more and more Russians could imagine themselves joining a political protest. Another poll showed that the happiness index is lowest in 14 years. But I think polling is just one indicator that we as journalists use to measure the atmosphere in Moscow. And the others are the interviews, but also some of the outrage we've seen on social media.
And how much of this outrage do you think is about the death toll in Ukraine? The head of GCHQ, a UK intelligence agency, said that 500,000 Russian soldiers had been killed since the conflict began in 2022.
As we remain steadfast in our support for Ukraine, Putin is going backwards on the battlefield. With new intelligence showing that almost 500,000 Russian soldiers have been killed since the conflict began.
How widely known is that in Russia itself?
Yeah, these figures are astonishing, really. More Russians have died in this war than any other wars combined, except the Second World War. Given these numbers, it's impossible for Russians to ignore this. But from the very start of the war, Russia has mobilized and recruited soldiers as much as possible away from Moscow and away from St. Petersburg, so in sort of the countryside, the poor areas. I did a story on a village far away in the north of Russia, northeast of Russia, where 30% of all male population went to fight, and many died. So in a village like that, obviously the war is felt very hard.
Yeah, and so when they hear Putin claiming that the war is going brilliantly, they have evidence to the contrary in terms of their sons who have not returned home.
Yeah, well, we've seen that at the start of the war that I think, because Russia thought that, this would be a quick war, they were prepared for sacrifices. And a lot of these men who died were glorified in state press and the media. And Russia made sure to take care of the families of the fallen. So they've given wives and children of men who died enormous amounts of money. These are figures that some of these men and their families had never seen before. So that helped to prevent some of the anger. But now, it's going in the fifth year, and Russia is struggling to recruit soldiers as much as they did at the beginning of the war. We know that around 30,000 soldiers per month are killed or injured, and until now, Russia was able to recruit as many each month. But now we're seeing a turning point.
Are we seeing now more Russians feeling emboldened to actually talk out publicly, or are they just giving anonymous comments to pollsters when they ring up?
Obviously, if you're an average Russian, you're not going to write on social media that you're against the war. And if you do, you'll be in jail the next day. But we've seen a shift among some celebrities, for example, on social media. There was this beauty blogger who's hugely popular with millions of followers called Victoria Bonya. She was a reality TV star, and she wrote this post in April.
Я это делаю от лица народа. Они меня об этом не просили, но внутри я чувствую, что нужно записать это видео. Почему? Потому что
she said that the Russian president has lost touch with his population. She addressed Putin, saying, "Russians are scared of you." And then she listed the list of grievances she had with what is going on in the country.
And is she in a gulag now, or is she
going to Russia? No, she actually lives in Monaco. But I think even if she was in Russia, I don't think the Russian authorities would go after her because she's a massive personality. Mm-hmm. And I think going after her would reveal some sort of panic in the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. Instead, the Kremlin has tried to coerce her. But we've seen other instances. There's this huge pro-war community online on Telegram, which is the Russian Facebook/WhatsApp/Twitter. And on Telegram, we've seen pro-war bloggers who have been very loyal to the Kremlin. And we've seen the taboo is breaking, that you can't criticize Putin. And one of these bloggers, I spoke to him in March. His name was Ilya Remeslov. And he went as far as calling for Putin to be put on trial. And he called Putin a war criminal.
Хотя Путин там в твоей жизни много чего такого наворотил, мы должны соблюдать закон исключительно в правовом поле, пусть суд.
The same day as I spoke to him, he was arrested. He was put into a psych ward. He's since come out of the psych ward, and he's toned down his criticism.
Tell us about this nickname that has started to circulate about Putin.
This nickname has already been around for a while, but it's now sort of growing in popularity, which is Ded v bunkere, which means the grandfather in a bunker. And it reflects both, obviously, Putin's time spent in bunkers away from the people, but also the fact that he's old. You know, Putin is 73, he has ruled this country for 26 years. And this nickname has specifically grown bigger because of Putin's new initiative to block the internet as much as possible. Putin himself famously doesn't use the internet. He doesn't have social media, unlike Trump or, you know, any Western official, really. He doesn't use a mobile phone, so he doesn't really understand what the internet means for, you know, millions of Russians. And a massive part of the recent outrage is this, the blocking of the internet, which started at the start of the war, but has intensified in recent months.
And what's the sort of official justification for blocking the internet?
To give you some context, Russia, shortly after the full-scale invasion of 2022, Russia already blocked many of the popular Western apps like Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Mm-hmm. But Russians could live with it because they used VPNs to circumvent the blocking, and they used their alternatives like Telegram and Vkontakte. But in recent months, Russia started blocking Telegram, which, you know, every Russian I know uses for daily communication. And more recently, we've seen the government completely blocking the internet. So if you're someone in Moscow, you wouldn't be able to order a taxi, order food, pay for services. And that led to complete shutdowns of these mega cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg, where, you know, 2 million people work as food delivery guys, taxi drivers. And the official reasoning behind this is that Russia says that it helps prevent Ukrainian drone attacks. Hmm. Experts and critics don't really buy it. You know, Ukraine has been able to continue their drone attacks. Another reason is that the Russian security services, they fear Ukrainian partisan attacks on Russian generals, on high officials, and many of these attacks are coordinated via Telegram, where Ukraine finds, you know, local collaborators on Telegram. On Tuesday, a senior Russian commander was blown up inside his car outside Moscow, in what appears to be the latest of the string of assassinations against high Russian targets. So that could be another reason. And I think the final reason is just that Russia wants to have control over the internet and wants to be able to shut it down whenever it wants to.
Mm. And how are Russians reacting to this siege, really, and not being able to get online?
That has been the number one trigger this year for this anger that we've seen.
I can't access my messages. Phones aren't loading. Authorities want to tie everyone to the national messenger, Max, which few people want to download and use.
In the morning, a man got lost here. He was terrified. We showed him the way. We're all feeling anxious these days.
Russians have been forced to buy paper maps. Some Russians have bought walkie-talkies, you know, so you know, Russia is back.
Really?
To, back to the 90s. Since the start of the war, Vladimir Putin made this sort of unspoken social contract with the Russian population that, you know, I'll be waging this war and I'll mostly leave the big cities out of it. You know, as an average Russian, you will be able to live the way you're used to. Maybe you won't be able to buy the Western brands that you're used to, but otherwise, you know, life will still be comfortable. But now that social contract appears to be broken, and that has frustrated a lot of people.
And let's talk a bit about Victory Day, a big day in the Russian calendar, which was celebrated last month, which marked the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. How did that play out? Because it was a little different this year, wasn't it?
Victory Day is, you know, arguably the biggest holiday in Russia. You know, growing up as a kid, it was something that everyone looked forward to. And Vladimir Putin only made it bigger, and he introduced these mass military parades. Initially, Victory Day was a lot about remembrance, you know, remembrance of all the sacrifices to defeat the Nazis. But for Putin, it also became an instrument to show Russia's might and for him to project the power that he has. So we've seen these mass military parades happening every year, and they continued even after the Russia's full-scale invasion. But this year, for the first time, Russia was forced to scale back the military parade. So there were no tanks. There were only a few jets flying around. But it was a huge embarrassment for Putin.
They are worried their big day could be disrupted. So as a result, they've decided to scale back this year's parade.
I think many realize that this is hugely embarrassing, especially because, you know, when Vladimir Putin launched the full-scale invasion, he thought that within a month or two, they would, you know, be inside Kiev.
And now,
now, you know, we have a world where Russia actually has to scale down its own parade inside Moscow.
Yeah, because it's so frightened of Ukrainian drones, which did manage to hit Moscow last month, right? In a pretty shocking incident for Moscow residents.
Yeah, we've seen more and more drone attacks. We've seen drone attacks last week in St. Petersburg during Putin's famous SPIF, which is the Economic Forum, also dubbed the Russian Davos.
Russia says its air defenses have been responding to a Ukrainian drone attack on the area around St. Petersburg.
Guests walked into the conference hall as smoke rose above St. Petersburg. And obviously these are symbolic attacks by Ukraine. So yeah, the drones are penetrating, you know, most cities far, far away from Ukraine.
But at the same time, Putin has claimed on a number of occasions, including, I think, at this Victory Day parade, that the war is coming to a close.
Которая продолжается до сих пор. Я думаю, что дело идет к завершению, но все-таки это серьезный.
Do you think he really believes that? And if so, why?
Yeah, that phrase made headlines around the world.
Yeah.
But I think many misinterpreted what Putin was saying.
Okay.
Later on, he also tried to explain what he meant. And in his worldview, the war might be coming to an end, but not because he's willing to sit down and talk it out with Zelensky, but because he believes he's winning. And I think that's a crucial thing that I hope, you know, listeners understand is in Vladimir Putin's mind, the war is going well.
Right, with half a million Russian dead soldiers.
You know, with drones flying into Russian cities every day. You know, he believes that, and this is what I hear from people around him, he still believes that even though things are hard in Russia, things are harder in Ukraine. And that, you know, Ukraine is having bigger man shortages on the front line, and Ukraine will collapse at any moment. And we've seen, you know, Putin repeating that again and again and again, that I will not stop until I reach my military goals.
Right. And is there any evidence that Russia is actually winning? Because Vladimir Zelensky gave a fairly upbeat interview to our colleagues Luke Harding and Pippa Krier this week, in which he insisted that Russia was not advancing.
And Russia, we can't say that they are losing this war, but we can say that they are losing this initiative each day, day by day. They're losing this.
And he also wrote to Putin, didn't he, last week, suggesting that they kind of meet together face to face, mano a mano, and thrash out some sort of deal.
Based on all the military analysis that we have at this point, shows that Russia is advancing, but advancing at a very, very slow rate. And if they continue to advance at this slow rate, it would take them years, it took decades to capture the whole of Donbass, which is sort of the minimum that Putin wants. But there's no indication that that shows that Ukraine is facing an immediate collapse. So, you know, the question is, why does Putin think this way? Mm. You know, and I think there are different theories behind that, but, you know, it does seem like he's receiving very upbeat, rosy military reports from his commanders. There's this, you know, good example that we've seen play out in public where last year a military commander told him in front of, it was televised that, you know, Russia captured the city of Kupiansk in northern Ukraine.
Мои отряды 68-й мотострелковой дивизии 6-й армии завершили освобождение города Купянск.
То есть все. Купянск is still controlled by Ukraine. So, you know, even though this commander told Putin that, you know, we've captured Kupiansk, you know, this was just wrong information.
You said that the mood appears to be darkening in Russia, not only because of the enormous death toll, but also because of the effect that it's having on the economy. You mentioned this sort of Russian Davos that took place in St. Petersburg last week. What have we learned about how the Russian economy is actually doing right now?
So the Russian economy is slowing down. I mean, that is clear. We're seeing that in statistics, but, you know, also from reports from Putin's own officials who have warned him that, you know, they can't continue spending on the military as much as they do right now.
Okay, so they sometimes tell him the truth.
Sometimes, the economic bloc, you know, they deal with numbers and they're often a bit more realistic.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to realize that in the first 2-3 years of the war, Russia's economy actually was booming, and a lot of people who inside Russia were saying that they never made as much money as they did in the first 2-3 years of the war. I mean, I think it's a classic case of a war economy where lots of money was pushed into the economy, a lot of the reserves. So people's salaries were rising. A lot of the families of soldiers, you know, suddenly became rich because of all this money they received from, you know, their death husbands. But over the last 2 years, we've seen a turning point. And now when I speak to Russians, they say things are very hard. Inflation is rising and the Russian government has taxed a lot of the small and middle businesses in order to keep on spending on the war. So we're seeing a turning point and we're seeing that it's getting much harder for an average Russian.
And what about the business elite in Russia, the oligarchs? They play a key role, don't they, in Putin's Russia? They're in his inner circle. Are they telling him any hard truths yet?
A few weeks ago, Putin got all the oligarchs together again, and he asked them to contribute to the war.
Oh, financially?
Financially, and some did. I think together they contributed some $3 billion, which is not an insignificant sum. But privately, from the very start of the war, many of the sort of business elites were horrified by the war. But, you know, they're scared. They're scared to speak out in public. You know, I speak to some of them. They realize how bad this war is going. You know, one of them told me that there's this profound disappointment in Putin. You know, quite strong words, but again, they won't speak out in public because they're scared to lose everything they have. You know, we've seen that few businessmen that have spoken out and have left the country, you know, their business, they've been stripped off their businesses and they've lost everything they have. One big Russian businessman who did leave, I spoke to him. His name is Oleg Tinkov, and he now lives abroad. Oh, yeah. Very critical of Putin.
He's got a cycling team, hasn't he, Tinkov?
He used to, yeah, he used to, not anymore. But he, you know, he compared it to me like that the Russian businessmen and the sort of oligarchs, they're playing Russian roulette. They just hope that they don't get hit, but their, you know, neighbor might get hit. They're just sitting it out and hoping that, you know, this will end at some point.
Coming up, could Putin face a coup anytime soon?
Full Story is supported by EY Parthenon. EY Parthenon is the global strategy consulting practice of EY, working with CEOs, boards, investors, and governments on their most critical decisions. They bring deep sector expertise, an investor mindset, and advanced technology to bring clarity to complex challenges. EY Parthenon helps leaders make better decisions in moments of change, anticipating what's next, finding opportunity in uncertainty, and translating complex shifts into real-world outcomes, turning insight into action. For more insights, go to ey.com/au/Parthenon. EY Parthenon, transformative strategy and transactions. Solutions that work in practice, not just on paper.